Thank you, and thank you for the invitation. I have been in Santa Barbara before, but it was so long ago that everything is new here. So I'm very glad to be here, and I'm very glad to be telling you about the how we are doing with LIGO detectors now and what we expect to do in the near future. I don't have to tell you about gravitational waves, but I will tell you a little bit anyway. I'll tell you just the basics that you need to know to see how we do with our detectors. Gravitational waves, Einstein told us, are quadrupolar distortions of distances between freely falling masses. That's a technical definition of the distortion that we expect. And the cartoon that we usually have in mind is that if we have freely falling masses that are arranged in a circle, meaning that this distance is the same as that distance, or the distance of every mass to the center of the circle is the same, and a gravitational wave goes through, then the distances are going to change in such a way that the circle will become an ellipse, and then a circle again, and then an ellipse in the orthogonal direction, and then a circle again. We have two polarizations, because these are quadrupolar waves, and the two polarizations are different in the sense that if one polarization transforms a circle into an ellipse this way, and we call that the plus polarization, and the other one transforms a circle into an ellipse this way, and that is the cross polarization. So they both do more or less the same, but the important thing to keep in mind is that what we are measuring, what we need to measure to detect these gravitational waves, are distances between particles. So we are not looking at the motion of a single particle. We're going to be talking about pendulums, we're going to be talking about masses, but we're not looking at the motion of any single mass, we're looking at the distances between these masses. As you probably know, there's been many attempts to detect gravitational waves with resonant bar detectors. That's a different technology that has been going on. It's still going on for about 30 years, although the last detector in the U.S. was turned off a couple of weeks ago. That was Allegro in Louisiana State University. We hope we'll turn it on sometime. But it had been working until a few weeks ago. What the LIGO detectors are, and what we call the new technology, although it's also several decades old now, is to use interferometers, just the old Michelson-Morley interferometers, to detect these distortions. The basic idea is that you have a beam splitter that you will take as a reference for the center of the circle, and then you will put mirrors at the end, and then you will use the interferometer to detect these differences between this distance and that distance. And those are exactly the distances that are going to change if there is a gravitational wave going through. So the output in this photo detector tells you, from the interference pattern that you measured, not this distance, not that distance, not the motion of that mirror, not the motion of that mirror, but only the difference between that distance and that distance. And that's exactly what the gravitational wave will change. Now, of course, when we think about this cartoon, these are freely falling masses. When we think about the Michelson-Morley interferometer, if you remember those old pictures of the Michelson-Morley interferometer, these were small mirrors that were mounted very tightly to a table, so those are certainly not freely falling masses. The way we do this is we suspend these mirrors in pendulums, and then they are approximately free in the horizontal direction at frequencies way above the pendulum frequency. So they're not truly free masses in all directions, they're only free masses in the horizontal direction and in certain frequency bands. Those are frequencies above the pendulum frequency. So that tells you that these ground-based detectors will have a frequency band that will be above normal pendulum frequencies. And if you remember your introductory physics, the frequency of the pendulum depends on the length, so it's about a hertz, half a hertz for our pendulum. And it also tells you that we are only sensitive to gravitational waves on the horizontal plane. So gravitational waves traveling, arriving from a different direction will also produce a difference in the distance, but it will be smaller. So we can optimally detect gravitational waves coming from directly above, and with a smaller sensitivity directions from gravitational waves from other directions. You may or may not remember, but the unit for gravitational waves is no unit. It's strain. The strength of gravitational waves is a distortion of space-time that tells you not about how much this mass is moving back and forth. That would be a change in distance. That would be a distance. It's only the ratio of that change in distance divided by that distance. And that's why it doesn't have a unit. It's strain unit. So a key for that is that for a given gravitational wave of a fixed strength, then the longer this length, the larger the change in length. So the longer your interferometer, the easier it is to measure your signal. And that's why you have spent your taxes in our detectors to make them very, very long. The LIGO detectors are 4 kilometers long. Two of the LIGO detectors are 4 kilometers long. The other is 2 kilometers long, because that makes us better able to measure small strains for a given precision in change in distance. Now, how good do they have to be? Well, again, many people in the audience are better experts than me, but for some few sources, you can calculate the strength of those sources given a distance. That actually turns out to be quite difficult for most sources, so we usually concentrate on binary systems when they are far enough away that they can be approximated as point masses. Then one can use what's called post-Newtonian approximations to calculate the gravitational wave. It will look like a chirp, because as the system orbits, it's emitting these gravitational waves, it's losing energy, and then it's getting closer. The orbit is shrinking. They're getting closer and closer. That's what Taylor and Hulse measured and got the Nobel Prize for. So they did measure this shrinking of the orbit. And if we translate that into a strain as a function of time, it will look like a chirp that has increasing frequency and increasing amplitude. And we can calculate this amplitude before we get too close to the coalescence. As long as we can assume these masses are point masses, we can calculate this amplitude as a function of distance and as a function of position on the sky and orbit orientation. So if we have a system in the Virgo cluster, and if it has some average orientation, and if we assume that these are neutron stars, then the coalescence frequency will be around 1500 hertz. So that's in the LIGO band. It's way above the pendulum frequency. We will be sensitive to these frequencies. And the strain is about 10 to the minus 21 for a system in the Virgo cluster. So these are small numbers. There are astronomers in the audience. We all know about small numbers and large numbers. This doesn't mean much until you want to translate it into an actual measurable number. So, for example, if you think that the beam splitter is in the sun, and this mirror is in the Earth, and this mirror is in another planet 90 degrees away, so you have a Michelson-Morley interferometer of one astronomical unit arm length, that's very long for L, the delta L that you're going to measure is one atomic diameter. So 4 kilometers is very expensive and very long, but we have to be measuring distances, changes in distance between 4 kilometers this way and 4 kilometers that way, that are subatomic distances. In fact, the distances that we're going to measure are 10 to the minus 18, 10 to the minus 19 meters. Those are subnuclear distances. So, of course, the first question that arises is, how can you do that? You don't want to be doing nuclear physics or quarks. And that's because we are not looking at any particular point in this mirror. We're only looking at changes in this distance with respect to that distance at high frequencies. So we're measuring that change in distance at, say, 100 hertz. So we cannot say that the difference in distance between this arm and that arm is 10 to the minus 18 meters longer today than it was yesterday. That we cannot say. We cannot measure the arm length to that precision either. What we can say, and what we are doing already, and we have been doing for more than a year now, is whether this distance, this tension with respect to that distance, at 100 Hertz by 10 to the minus 18 meters or more. And those are subnuclear distances, but they are measurements, macroscopic measurements of these macroscopic distances. So we are not doing nuclear physics. We're doing astrophysics. You probably have heard many times, I hope, about the LIGO project. That, again, is funded by NSF, and that means you, by Ms. Taxes. There are two observatories, one in Livingston, Louisiana, the other in Hanford, Washington. The landscape is completely different in both. This is desert landscape. This is forest. It's a swamp. There's lots of water, lots of trees. Logging, this is actually logging forest. I live about 30 miles from this side, and I have to say I like this landscape better than that. Green is nice, it makes you happy. But we have two observatories because, of course, gravitational waves have not been detected, we have not seen. They are very, very small, so we are talking about very small distances. So to be sure that for that first detection, and to be sure that we can do astrophysics with the many detections that will follow, we want to have coincidences between observatories. We also have, in the Hanford Observatory, two detectors. We have a 2-kilometer detector and a 4-kilometer detector. These are independent detectors. The systems are completely independent. They're housed in the same vacuum system. Something I didn't mention, but you also probably know, is that this is all in vacuum. High, ultra-high vacuum, minus 9 torr. So they are in the same vacuum system, but they are completely independent detectors. So the LIGO observatory has three independent detectors. However, there are a lot more than the people working in these observatories. The LIGO project was a grant that was granted to Caltech and MIT, but since then we have built a community that's working not just on the analysis of the data, which takes a lot more work than I would have thought, but also on the experiment itself, developing the R&D for advanced detectors, developing the commissioning, doing the commissioning of these detectors. This is all done by a community called the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. We have our own website, which is different than the LIGO Lab website, which you probably may be more familiar with, and that is where we have all our results. The first, the collaboration was founded in the 1996, and the first spokesperson was Ray Wise, the second spokesperson was Peter Tolson, my advisor. Recently we had a new election, and Dave Ritzy from the University of Florida is the new spokesperson. There's about 540 members in the collaboration and 52 institutions from all around the world. This is not just a US collaboration. Now, this is the Institute for Theoretical Physics, so I thought it wouldn't be very appropriate to talk about all the fun experimental details. So this is my one slide about what the experiment is about. I do have another whole talk that I could give on the experimental details, but let me just show you what this simple Michelson interferometer actually looks like. The mirrors are big mirrors, 25 centimeters diameter, 10 centimeters thick. They're mirrors in the infrared. The laser that we use is an indium gallium laser in the infrared. So they look kind of reddish. They're actually very pretty. They're state-of-the-art in coating and polishing. They were the best you could buy at the time. In fact, they were so good that they couldn't tell us how good they were. We had to install them in our system to be able to measure the roughness of the surface or even the curvature of the mirror. The mirrors are hanging in input pendulums in the suspension frames. The suspension frames have little coils that push on little magnets that are glued to these mirrors. The whole thing is set up in the free vacuum on top of a seismic isolation system. This is a passive seismic isolation system. We have since then installed active seismic isolation on the outside of the vacuum chamber in Livingston. This is all in vacuum, so this is a beam-splitted vacuum chamber. in the arms, these are not simple Michelson arms. We actually have optical cavities. Those are Faber-Perot cavities that we have to keep resonant. So the control system of these interferometers is actually quite complicated. And fan, I should say, fan is the key word here. This is a vacuum chamber that has the input mass for one of the arms. This is the input mass for the other arm. So this is all in the corner station. The beam travels in a vacuum tube, which is 1.2 meters in diameter. It's within an enclosure. It has a concrete enclosure that protects the beam tube from wind, from the weather, from bullets that sometimes we have in Louisiana and other places, from police cars crashing into the beam tubes. We had that in Hanford. From fire, we had a fire brush fire going through the detector in Hanford. So these enclosures had paid their price, and they've done quite well. We have a control room that looks very sophisticated for people who go in there. It's full of computers. Most of our systems are actually digital systems, digital control systems. So it's not just looking at the data that we store on this. That is the gravitational wave standard that you see there. We don't put it on the wall anymore. We have more interesting things to put on the wall. But this is what the gravitational wave standard looks like. That's the output of that photo detector. But there's lots of other things you have to monitor. So we always have operators who take care of the detector and scientific monitors from physicists from the collaboration that look at the data continuously to evaluate data quality. Most of the things we do, the mirrors were bought, the vacuum system was bought and installed by a commercial company, but these people are all people I know. These are all people in the lab, people in the groups that have done this by hand. The photodetectors, they're worked on by hand. This is Nergis Mamerbal, and this is Ray White from MIT, and that's what we do at the site. Whenever something breaks, we don't have anywhere to stand to fix it. We fix it. We take care of all the instruments. This is most of the things we have are actually made by ourselves. The detectors had light in there, and they were turned on, unlocked. All the optical cavities were resonant for the first time in about 2001. But of course, then you measure the noise and you compare the noise that you have with the noise that you expect, with the goal that you have, and we were orders of magnitude off. So in 2002, this was our noise. This is a noise spectral density for the strain as a function of frequency. So you can see that it's smallest, where the noise is small, that's good, because your signal has to be above the noise. So smaller is better for this curve. This is what we had in 2002. And in strain per square root of hertz, because this is a strain spectral density, we had a minimum at about 10 to the minus 20. And that sounds OK. I told you that 10 to the minus 21 would get us to the Virgo cluster. But it's not OK, because again, this is a spectral density. If you want to compare this to the Church signal I showed you before, what you have to do is say, well, let's look at the band between 100 and 200 hertz. And then the noise that you have at those frequencies will be the square of this curve integrated in frequency. And that's why you have these strange units of square root of hertz. And that noise for this curve is about 10 to the minus 18. So that wasn't so good. It was the best sensitivity to gravitational waves at those frequencies at this time. So by that time, these detectors were already the best detectors that had ever been taking data at those frequencies. So, of course, we had to make it better, but we stopped for a while and we took data. We called that our first science run, S1. And that way, we also could practice on our methods to look for gravitational waves at these frequencies. And then we stopped taking data, and we kept working on the detector to make it better. This solid curve was our goal. That goal was set in the early 80s, early 80s in the proposals that were sent to the National Science Foundation, and they assumed that the noise was going to be limited by... I think I used the battery.
Every LIGO person should have their own laser.
We do, but they're big. and they're infrared, so they're not in the visible. So this was assumed to be the limit to the sensitivity by limited by shot noise, that's a quantum noise in the laser. This would be the limit due to the seismic noise through the pendulum and the seismic isolation that was planned. And this was the limit due to the Brownian motion of the masses. This is all at room temperature, so the masses are moving around due to Brownian motion. Even though the center of mass may not be moving, the surface of the mirror will be moving, because, and that's what we sense with the laser. So this was the limit from the Brownian motion at the time. This curve we have here is one. It's not the best anymore, but it is the curve that we had in what we call our fifth science run that started in November of 2005. So between our first science run in 2002 and the one we are taking data now on, S5, we stopped several times, and you can see the improvement in each curve. We have been publishing papers and doing the analysis for each of these science runs. So if you look at the LIGO.org page, then you will find papers with our searches in S1, S2, S3, S4, S5. S3 is the one we like the least, so you won't find many papers on S3. Human time. It's mostly short noise. This was not short noise limited. All these were short noise limited. But then you say, why was this so much higher than that? That's because we couldn't use all the light that we put in the detector. You start with a 10-watt laser, but it turns out that mirrors bend around, and then the interference pattern is not so good. And in principle, you're working in the dark spot. You're making the interference coming out of the arms to be destructive interference for maximum sensitivity, but it's not destructive because the interference, the wavefronts, are distorted, and there's no way to make them interfere destructively. So we had to do a lot of alignment control systems, and we had to do thermal control systems. We are heating up the mirrors, compensating for the heating up due to the main laser, so that these wavefronts are very similar to each other, and then they can produce the destructive interference that you want. Even now, we are limited by short noise, but we are not using all the light that we could. So we could be even more sensitive than this, but we need to install a few more things to get there. So being short noise limited doesn't mean that you are at your goal sensitivity. It's being short noise limited using all the light that you have in the laser. And that's actually a condition that's very strict. There's also lots of other things. There was some electronic noise in here. There was some upconversion noise from low frequencies. Every little bit took months of work to diagnose and see. But that was the fun part. So what do we look for in the data that we took in all these science runs and the data we're taking now? Well, it turns out that there are, as you know, different sources of gravitational waves, and the different sources produce qualitatively different kinds of gravitational waves. So in the collaboration, we have set up four data analysis groups that look for these four, arbitrarily classified, four different classes of gravitational waves. One of those is the ones of the charts I was showing you before, coming from binary systems. And these are systems of compact stars, neutron stars, small black holes, small being smaller than one solar mass, or black holes smaller than about 50 solar masses. That's about the limit that we have in sensitivity in the frequency band. So if we have a binary system of compact stars, then we can see the chirp waveform before coalescence. We could see the merger, and we are waiting for these for those numerical relativity waveforms that are coming out to see if we can do a better job of looking for those. And we also have a ring down. So we have a template. This is a short transient. It is at most a couple of minutes long, but it is a transient for which we have a template. So those you look for using what you know about the waveform. There's also gravitational waves produced by rotating stars. Now, the source has to have a quadrupole, a mass quadrupole, if it's going to produce a gravitational wave. A binary system has a trivial quadrupole that one can calculate. A spherical star does not have a quadrupole. So if we have a perfect spherical star, no matter how fast it is rotating, it will not produce gravitational waves. It has to have some asymmetry. And depending on what kind of asymmetry it has, whether you have an asymmetric star that's wobbling, so it's rotating and precessing, or whether you have an asymmetric star that's rotating about an axis, you will have sine waves at the frequency of rotation or at twice the frequency of rotation of the star. And these are simple sine waves at the source. They're Doppler shifted on Earth, because the Earth is moving with respect to the source, and they are continuous waves. So the methods to look for these sources has to be very different than the one to look for these. For these, you use integration in time, you look at some frequency beam, you modulate with the Doppler shift, so the methods are very different. We look for a stochastic background. There's a predicted stochastic background of gravitational waves coming from the inflationary period, but there's also a stochastic background that could be there if there are sources, lots of burst sources that are unresolved, lots of different bursts of noise that are unresolved. Either way, the noise, the signal would look like a noisy background that is also always there. The way we look for this is looking for correlations between two detectors, because in a single detector, this noise, this cosmological gravitational wave, or just gravitational wave, looks just like the noise that produces this curve. There's no way for us to differentiate with a single detector between the cosmological background and the noise, just the Brownian noise background. The way we do differentiate is looking for correlations between detectors. And finally, there's bursts, and those are brief transients for which we don't have a good template. If we have a template, then we look for those the same way we look for binary systems. But if we don't have a template, then you use some method that doesn't assume anything about the gravitational wave. For example, wavelet transport. That's our favorite one. But these are looking at small, at brief transients without a model, and that's the signals that we would expect, for example, from supernova explosions, although those methods we expect also to be able to detect mergers of binary systems and signals that are associated with bursts in the electromagnetic spectrum, for example, gamma ray bursts. So those are the four signals we look for. We have done searches in all these ones for all these signals. We are now publishing papers. I'll show you the preprint numbers for the S4. We are doing these searches in S5.2, but we probably will wait until we finish taking data before, so we can use it all to produce a result. So let me tell you a little bit about the signals we have, the searches we have done. This is going to be a bit more technical, so please feel free to interrupt if the graphs seem a bit too obscure, but also know that you can go and look in more detail at these results if you go to our papers. So looking for the binary system, that's my favorite system because that's a group I work on. As I said, what we do is we use templates that assume we know the waveform. And then we use optimal filtering for that. Now, the template that we always show is that one, which looks simple enough, and it has only two parameters, and those are the two masses of the binary system. But truly, there's a lot more parameters in there. There's the distance, there's the orientation, there's the position. Those are all convolved in just an overall amplitude factor. There's the two masses. Those do give us different templates. there's a coalescence time. That's just what you look by looking at your template in the data. There's a coalescence phase, but then there's also spin if the systems are spinning, and that's what you expect the systems to do if these are black holes. If they are neutron stars, the spin doesn't change much efficiency of our systems, but if these are black holes, then the waveforms would look very different. So we have to put all of that, and that brings us endless trouble. One nice thing about simple templates, and those are those ones above, for neutron stars, is that you can translate the noise curve I showed you before, the one that we got for S1, S2, S3, into a distance. You can translate that into the distance at which you can see a binary neutron star system that is averagely oriented, so you don't assume that it's optimally oriented, you assume it's in an average position in the sky and with an average position of the orbit. And we do, if you go to and visit the LIGO observatories, you will see that on the wall, you will see a 12-hour record of that. If you look at our electronic logs, and those are public, you can get to those every day. I have a web page later that I can show you, showing how we did today. Then you see the time series of that range in megaparsecs for the three detectors, and that's L1 in green, H1, that's a 4-kilometer detector in Hanford in red, and the 2-kilometer detector in blue. This is a 2-kilometer detector in Hanford. So here you see what difference the length makes. The 2-kilometer detector is half as long, and it's about half as sensitive. That's because we have about the same sensitivity in distance. In fact, it's actually a bit better for this one than for this. But in strain, it's half the strain, so we see only half as far. For the 4-kilometer detectors, they are about the same. We are on at a range of about 15 megaparsecs. That is the distance to the Virgo cluster. The Virgo cluster is about 15 megaparsecs away, 17, I think, but close enough. So that means that we have about 50% efficiency to systems in the Virgo cluster, and that was the goal.
Can you see further by using the
I'd like to say yes, but the truth is we only see this far if we use coincidence. This is assuming that we have a signal-to-noise ratio of 8. That gives us a low false alarm rate only in coincidence. If we use a single, if you had Gaussian noise, that would be enough to give you a 1% false alarm rate in one detector, but we don't have Gaussian noise. So we wish we could multiply this by square root of 2, but we don't, and we shouldn't. Now, this is the average distance. We can see farther if the system happens to be in a sweet spot, if it happens to be optimally aligned and optimally oriented. So we can actually see quite farther away. We can also see farther away if we look for higher masses rather than neutron stars. Neutron stars have 1.4 solar masses. If we look at black holes of 10 solar masses, then the signals are stronger, so we see farther away. I was trying to regenerate this plot with the latest month of data, and I failed to do that in time, so I'm showing you a plot that's 1 month outdated. But you can see here how we have done during S5. S5 started in November 2005, and I'm plotting here the same range I showed you for those 12 hours a little earlier this month. This is that same range, again in the same color, for L1 in green, H1 in red, H2 in blue. For a year and a half. This started in November 2005. It's now May 2007. And you'll have to believe me that we have done a bit better than what's shown in there in the last month. The last month has been one of our best months. So we have done very well. Our goals were 5 megaparsecs for H1, 10 megaparsecs for the 4-kilometer detectors, and we have done quite a bit better than that. You can also see jumps in the sensitivity in here for L1, and you can also see bad times in the fall. That's what you get when you take years' worth of data. There are good times and bad times, and sometimes you work on the detector and you get better sensitivity. So we have kept working once in a while to improve sensitivity. We have taken already a lot of data. This I did update for today. There's been 573 days of days that we have been operating. We have had about the 75% duty factor in Hanford, a bit smaller in Livingston. That's because we have a bit higher seismic noise in Livingston, but also we had a lot of construction during the beginning of S5. During this month, we were building a very nice science education center in the Livingston Observatory that I hope you can visit. It has lots of toys, those toys that you find in the Science Museum. These were designed by the San Francisco Exploratorium, and physicists actually like them a lot more than children. So if you go there, you like them. I hope you do. We have had, for triple coincidence, about a 50% duty cycle. We want a year's worth of data. That's why we are probably going to be taking data until later this fall to get a year's worth of real data, triple coincidence data. We have been on with one or more LIGO detector 90% of the time. We have also been running in coincidence with the German detector, the British-German Geo-600 detector, that is also considered the LIGO scientific collaboration detector because they are part of the collaboration. And if you put them in the network, then we have been on 95% of the time. Since May 18, we have begun taking data jointly with the Virgo detector. The Virgo detector turned online. They are doing, their range is a bit half of H2, so they're about here, but they're on. So now we have 5 detectors in a network that's taking data all together. And that was since May 18, and we'll keep doing that for the rest of the, for the next four months or so.
Is the Virgo sensitivity where they expect it to be, or is it
no? No, it's not quite. They've only been commissioning it for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. So they're about a year or two behind LIGO. So their sensitivity is about what ours was in S3. But it's still very good for the coverage and for practicing. Analyzing data taken in different ways. We have different sampling rates. We have the same technology, but different idiosyncrasy. I can say that word. Okay, so let me tell you about the results. Again, looking for binary systems, I'm going to tell you about what we got in S4. That paper is in the archive now. And one way to plot what we found is looking at a scatter plot of triggers. These are triggers that are coincident in two detectors, one Hanford detector and one Livingston detector. So this is a signal-to-noise ratio that we measured for that trigger in the Hanford detector. This is a signal-to-noise ratio that we measure in the other detector, either the H2 detector or the L1 detector. And what we have in here is these, which I wish I could tell you, are detected signals. These are what detected signals would look like, except that we injected them. These are simulated signals. These are what we call software injection. So this is what we would like to see. These dots in here are our estimate of the false alarms that we would have in the same amount of time. The way we measure that is we look for coincidences but shifting the time of one detector with respect to the other. So we fake the time, we lie about the time in one detector, but then we use the same method, exactly the same method, to look for coincidences. But now we know that every coincidence we find is a false alarm, because the times are 15 seconds apart, and there's no gravitational wave that can produce triggers that are that far away. So this is our estimate of the false alarm. So these, we probably wouldn't be able to claim these injections as detections if they were real tricks, but we would be able to claim these. So what we do to quantify that is we make a histogram, and this is a cumulative histogram of the number of events we have seen, again in S4, looking for binary neutral stars, versus the signal-to-noise ratio. Now, this is a combined statistic, combining the square of this plus the square of that. And the blue points in here are the actual coincidences that we found. So we found a handful of coincidences in S4. S4 was 1 month long. And we found a handful of coincidences. Most of these were H1L1 coincidences, the two best detectors. This is our loudest trigger. The red causes are our estimate of the mean background rate at that strength. And the yellow bars are one sigma variations on that false alarm rate. So what you really want to see, if you had a coincidence that had an SNR of 8 in each detector, then you would have SNR squared 64 times 2 is 128. You would have one coincidence out here. And then that would be way above your background. That's what we want to see. We didn't see any of that. We saw coincidences, but they were all consistent with our false alarm rate. So we didn't detect any gravitational waves in S4. But we can, since we know how sensitive we were, we can translate that into how far we could see and translate that into a limit, an upper limit on the rate of coalescence. And that rate depends on the mass. For S4, we actually searched for small black holes, like primordial black holes, with less than one solar mass in each star, for what we call binary neutron stars, and that is a range of masses between 1 and 3 solar masses for each one, so the total mass is up to 6. And for black holes, for which we use a slightly different method. So this is an upper limit on the rate per year for L10. L10 means 10 to the 10 solar luminosities in the blue. The Milky Way has about 1.6 L10. So if you multiply this by 2, you have a galactic upper limit per year. So 1 would be about 2 coalescences per year for Milky Way. And these are the upper limits we got. You can see that they get better, that means smaller, with higher masses. They're not as good. You would expect these to keep going down in here for black holes, because you can see farther when you look for black holes. The problem is that for these signals, we have a higher false alarm rate. So when you fold in your false alarm rate, then the upper limit that you can set is not as good. This is the wishful slide. This is what you would like to do when searching for black holes. This is a plot of the horizon distance, that is the maximum distance for which you can see binary neutron stars, and that's about 25 megaparsecs. That's farther than the Virgo cluster, and that's because you are assuming that these are optimally oriented. That's why we call this horizon distance. But the same distance for black holes is quite a bit farther away. We measure this, an average of the first year for the run. We measure the horizon distance as a function of mass. And you can see that for binary neutron stars, which have a total mass of about 3 solar masses, we have these 25 megaparsecs. But as the total mass increases, our horizon distance increases. Our peak horizon distance is at about 25, 30 solar masses, and our reach is about 150 megaparsecs. Now, that assumes that an SNR of 8 can be seen with a low enough false alarm rate. And that we have proved yet. That is the most difficult part. Okay. Let me move quickly through the other 3 different classes of systems that we look for, and those are rotating stars, stochastic background, and burst signals, burst waveforms. So for spinning compact objects, those are rotating stars like pulsars, we are looking for sine waves, and our handle on those is looking for the Doppler shift. The way we distinguish a sine wave coming from the power line at 60 hertz and a a sine wave coming from the crab at 59.6 Hz is that a signal coming from the crab should be Doppler shift modulated by the motion of the Earth. The 60 Hz is always there, and it's not modulated with the Doppler shift. It doesn't care about the motion of the Earth. We could do this looking for every frequency bin for every pixel in the sky. That turns out to be very, very computationally expensive. I think you're going to hear my hair more than me on the microphone. So what we actually try to do is use your computers instead of ours. There's distributed computing system called Einstein at Home, and I hope you all have downloaded, and if you haven't, please do. If you download that system now, you will be helping us to analyze S5 data looking for spinning stars for every point in the sky. What we do with the data is we analyze it, and after we analyze it, we can set, in principle, if there is a detection, we have a probability density function for the strength of the gravitational wave. If there isn't any detection, then the probability density function looks like this, meaning that it's most likely to be zero, but then you can set up an upper limit. For example, if you want the 95% upper limit, then you look for the strength that gives you 95% of the integral under the curve. And that is a limit that you can set on the strength of the gravitational wave produced by a rotating system. Yes. We are doing that, but not for every source. We have two methods. We have five or six methods to look for these, and they all differ in how computationally efficient they are. Doing a coherent search, which is phase logging the signal from different detectors, is the most efficient one, but computationally it's very expensive. So the latest results we have done are for incoherent searches. But there's a few targets, there's a few systems for which a coherent search has been done. So this is a plot of the upper limit that we have set in strength versus the frequency that we have looked for. And these were targeted searches for pulsars, for known pulsars. So we know the position in the sky, and we know the frequency. So we look for that frequency in that position in the sky, and for that pulsar, we get this strength, or that strength, or this one, or this one, or that one. The solid line in here is the expected sensitivity that we would have for a 1 year worth of integration. You can see that the numbers in here are much smaller than the 10 to the minus 21 I was mentioning before. This is 10 to the minus 25 here. And that's because we are integrating in time. So we can go deeper the longer the data we analyze. You can also see these triangles in here. These triangles are existing upper limits for these pulsars that are derived from the spin down of these pulsars. Most of these pulsars are slowing down. So if you assume that they are slowing down because all the energy that's going away, it's going away in gravitational waves, which is a very unlikely scenario. But if you assume that, then you have an upper limit on the strength of gravitational waves. And you only see a few triangles in here, not because that method only applies to a few pulsars, but because most of these are down here. So most of those upper limits are much better than the ones we could set with a 1 year worth integrated data. However, the one up here, and that's a crab. The crab pulsar is a young pulsar, it's spinning down fast, and therefore the upper limit on the crab from the spin down is not as good. That's the limit that we have now beat with S5 data. This is our LIGO upper limit, and that's the spin down upper limit. So there's a paper in preparation with these numbers. We have beaten it by a factor of three or four. Now you can also see this line in here, and you might suspect what that is. That is at 60 Hz. The crab is rotating at about 30 Hz. Twice that frequency is 60, essentially 59.6, and that's the frequency of the crab, which is very close to the power line. Not close enough, so we can't set a good limit. We can set even better limits for our pulses, for other pulses, so our best limits are about 5 × 10⁻²⁶. That, I should say, it's all preliminary because it's not published yet. But. That's a fine distinction, but expected means that we haven't checked with astronomers on the phase of these pulsars yet. Most of these pulsars glitch once in a while. And if they glitch, then you have to stop and start again because you don't have continuity in the time integration. So the blue ones are the ones for which that has been checked, and the green ones are the ones for which that hasn't been checked yet. So that is what is expected if there is no glitch that makes you that makes integration time a bit smaller than what you. Okay, stochastic background. That, as I said, is in principle predicted by most inflationary theories. The way that the favorite way to parameterize it is in terms of energy density spectrum, so that omega, that is the logarithmic energy density ratio, the ratio of that energy density in a logarithmic frequency beam compared with a critical density, that would produce a power spectrum that goes like 1 over f cubed, an amplitude spectrum that goes like 1 over f to the 3/2. The amplitude would be about 10⁻²⁷ if omega is frequency independent and equal to 1. That's equal to 1 in gravitational wave energy, which you know it's not true. It's far from true. But the smaller the omega, the smaller the amplitude density that you're looking for. The latest results we have are from S4. In S4, this is our amplitude spectral density. This was the spectral density on which we could put an upper limit on. Again, it's a lot smaller than our noise spectral density, and that's because we integrate in time. This amplitude spectral density corresponds to an omega of about 7 × 10⁻⁵. So we know that there's less than that in energy, gravitational wave energy density. We can also do this search for one particular patch of the sky. This limit is for a frequency-independent spectrum isotropic in the sky and integrated over the sky. We can also do this on different patches in the sky, and we have done this. And again, it would be nice to interpret this as hot spots from which we detect gravitational waves. It's not. These are upper limits, and these are all consistent with background, the background that we expect. But it is a directional upper limit rather than an integrated upper limit. Yes, you have to choose a pixel size in here, and these are well, this is smooth for the plot, but the pixel size is quite big. It's quite big.
How large?
I think we divide the sky in squares, and that's about 300 squares. Yeah, so these are quite big. That's because it depends on the distance between the detectors, and the detectors are quite big. Finally, bursts. For bursts, as I said, we don't use any templates, we use a wavelet transform. But again, you're looking for coincidences. In this case, we look for triple coincidences, just to be sure, because these are unmodeled. And these are results for S4. Again, we have a histogram. This is a histogram, not a cumulative histogram, of the coincidences that we saw. And we saw a few triple coincidences, but then compared with the background that we expect. And you can see that we saw a few coincidences, triple coincidences, but all consistent with the background. What we would like to find is something out here that is a lot larger than the expected background. Now, what do you do with that if you want to set up an astrophysical interpretation? Well, one way to do that is to use just an arbitrary waveform, and we use a sine Gaussian, and then translate the limits that you have into energy that of a waveform like this versus frequency, that's the frequency of this sine Gaussian. So this is our detectable energy above background. If we had detected something, we would see this energy. We haven't, so this is our upper limit on the energy in mc squared versus frequency. And you can see that for systems in the Milky Way, for galactic systems, we can set up limits of about 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 mc squared. For systems in the Virgo cluster, those are about 10 to the minus 1 or 1 mc squared, depending on the frequency.
So you have a rate limit of less than 1 Mach of an event like that in Virgo?
Well, we haven't taken 2 years of data. We also do searches for gamma ray bursts. We have looked at all the gamma ray bursts in the science runs we have taken, but also for some special ones. And as you probably know, we haven't found anything. You would have heard if not. But we have set upper limits on strengths coincident with GBO 3 of 29. That was the first one confirmed as a supernova with a stop gamma repeater in December 2004. This was this huge magnetar that had it had a quasi-periodic oscillation, so we looked not only for the burst, but also for this oscillation afterwards. Didn't find anything. And we also looked for all the GRBs in S2, S3, S4. These are upper limits in H that we can set for each of those gamma ray bursts. And then we also do a statistical analysis to see if there was any excess, and there wasn't. We are doing the same analysis for S5, and I think there's now close to 70 GRBs that we've had during S5 coincident with data. So let me close. Let me get to the question, which is, when is it? I told you how all the things we have searched for, all the ways there are to not find things. So when is it that we're going to see something? Well, for the sources I talked about, for most of these, it's very difficult to make predictions, not just because the predictions are about the future, but also because we either don't know the rates of the systems or we don't know the strength of the systems. For example, for rotating stars, we don't know the asymmetry of the stars themselves, of the neutron stars. So we don't know the strength, we don't know how far we can see, we don't know what's the prediction from them, although they are quite small from the spin the spin down upper limit. For burst sources, well, by definition, they are unknown. So again, we don't have any good handle on strength or even rates. For a cosmological background, there are predictions. The predictions are usually smaller than the sensitivity that we have. For binary black holes, we can calculate the strength, but the rates and the populations are highly unknown, and that's a bit dangerous thing to say in this audience, but if you look at the papers, there are several orders of magnitudes of uncertainty in the predictions of how many binary systems of about 10 solar masses each there are in the neighborhood. So all we can say is that with 1 year's worth of data, we can probably begin to set interesting upper limits on some of these theories, but in general, there are no firm predictions. Binary neutron stars is the one system for which the amplitude is well known, and we can estimate a galactic rate, because there are all of three systems known in the galaxy that will coalesce in less than a Hubble time. So those are pulsars, so you have to extrapolate from that to how many not pulsar binary neutron star systems there are, and those are the ones in the galaxy. From that, you have to extrapolate to the rest of the universe. So if you do all of that, there's one rate in the middle of all of that we like to call the most likely rate of about 100 per million years, and that would give us, at our S5 sensitivity, a rate of 1 per 100 years. So that's a bit depressing, but I'd say that if I had a chance of 1 in 100 for a lottery ticket, I would buy it. So I'm looking. But that's, of course, not where we're going. Where we're going is towards advanced LIGO. Advanced LIGO is technology that we know how to do because we have been doing R&D on this. It gives us about a factor of 10 in sensitivity, but it also lets us see lower frequencies. So this is the spectrum we have now. This is the spectrum we expect from advanced LIGO. We could also have other tuned spectra. And if we had that spectrum, we could see at least 10 times farther. In fact, we can see a little farther for binary systems because we can look at lower frequencies. So the volume is 1,000 times larger. So everything we are doing with 1 year's worth of data can be done with 1 day's worth of data of advanced LIGO. So it's good that we reached advanced LIGO sensitivity. We proved that we can get the sensitivity we promised, but we don't want to spend years taking data because with advanced LIGO, it would be a lot more efficient. The predicted rate for binary neutron stars is 40 per year. And that's the most likely rate. It can be 10 times higher, it can be 10 times lower. But either way, it gives us an almost guaranteed detection, not just the first detection, but guaranteed astrophysics that we can do for binary neutron stars. And then there's, of course, binary black holes, which cannot be too far from the population that we have of binary neutron stars. So that is our goal. That is where we are going. How fast we're going to get there? Well, it's going to take some time. Congress is now studying the presidential request that has the first year of advanced LIGO funding, and everything is going well, so I hope you tell your Congress people that advanced LIGO is worth supporting, and science in general is worth supporting. And if everything goes well, in 2011 we will begin installing advanced LIGO. We hope to begin taking data a few years after that. It's difficult to predict the future, but again, by 2015 we hope to be taking data with advanced LIGO. In the meanwhile, however, I think we're going to have some fun installing some of the technology that's ready to try for advanced LIGO. And if we are lucky and everything goes well, that could give us a factor of 2. So we could have another science run before advanced LIGO that has a factor of 2 better sensitivity. We call that enhanced LIGO. So for today's spectrum in initial LIGO, we have a predicted rate of 1 per 100 years. For advanced LIGO, we have an almost guaranteed rate for binary neutron stars, and we can begin to do a lot of physics and astrophysics. So that's where we are going. Whatever is out there, if it is binary neutron stars or any of these other sources that we're looking for, we'll see them. We'll find out. Thank you.
Stan.
It looks so easy, right? We just have to divide the curve by 10. But and I work in the calibration team, so I could do that. But now, in principle, there's three keywords in that. To get from this to that, we need a higher power laser. To get from this, we need better seismic isolation, which is in part provided by multiple pendulums instead of a simple pendulum that we use now. And to get from this, we need to be more careful about the Brownian motion that appears in the gravitational wave band, which is also achieved by these multiple suspensions that we have. So it's seismic isolation, multiple suspensions, and higher power laser. It's about 200 million. That's the overall cost of advanced LIGO. This first year of funding is 30 million, but that includes part of the operation that is being funded now by operations, by an operations grant.
Yeah.
Well, to get this, we need 100 watts. We're hoping to get a bit more than that. So, you know, you get everything you can. But the laser is being designed by Laser Centrum in Hannover, and they are trying a 200 watt laser that's looking good. So we're hoping we can use that. For enhanced LIGO, we are already going to try lasers that they are actually providing us for free, just to try them out. And those are 30 watt lasers. We are using now 10 watt lasers.
You mentioned that in sort of analyzing the current data for the binary the neutron star approach, there were a couple of false coincidences. But how many cycles are matched directly to the false coincidence?
It depends on the masses you're looking for. When for the binary neutron star search, that's the one we're doing the best. For that one, we have in S5 we have tens of cycles. So
how many cycles it just happens to line up?
Well, not necessarily. If you only look at the peak in the signal to noise ratio for a given template, then you will see a peak, even if you don't match all of the cycles. If you have a big burst of signal that happens to match two or three cycles, but with a very high signal to noise ratio, then that will produce a peak in the SNR type 2. But we do have tests. Once we find the trigger, we apply what we call signal-based lasers. And these break up the template into smaller pieces, into 15 smaller pieces, and then we check the match into each piece, and if it's not what we expect into each piece, we throw it away. And even then, we have some false coins.
Bill? In the mechanical bar system, you know, we had a control run of resonance.
Yeah. Yes. The short answer is yes. That turns out to be a long answer, but for advanced LIGO, we are the optical topology has an extra mirror at the output, and that mirror produces another resonant cavity, which is resonant at the signal frequency. So you choose your frequency, and then that frequency determines the mirror. It's another test mass, right? We call this a signal recycling mirror, and this is a signal recycling cavity. And then this curve can be made resonant, and that would look like a curve that goes like that. In principle. In practice, that means changing the transmissivity of the mirror, so we probably will just start with this configuration, which is called the broadband configuration, and then try one resonant configuration. There are plans to maybe even run one detector in resonant configuration and one detector in broadband. That is not quite decided.
So your LIGO noise curve is predominantly a quantum noise. Could you say a little bit about what that is?
Yes. It has H bar. That's why we call it quantum. As opposed to Boltzmann constant. That's what we call thermal. But it is, in principle, it's just a counting statistic of the photons on the photodetector. That's what we call shot noise. If you only think about shot noise, then you think, well, the more photons, the better. So, because the noise goes like 1/(n), so you put as many photons as we can. But you know that will end up producing radiation pressure. If you have too many photons, then you begin pushing the mirrors, so that you lose the advantage. So, to really calculate the actual noise due to the photons in the system, to the photons in the electromagnetic field, you have to do a quantum treatment of the light, and that gives you both the radiation pressure and the shot noise limit together. And it turns out that when you put both together, you have these funny curves like this. And this has been done both in experiments and in theory by people like Alessandra Bonanno from Caltech and Maryland now, and Nergus Mavardala in MIT. It is actually very interesting. Very difficult papers to read, but very interesting.
All right, let's thank our members.